Good evening. Welcome to the 13th Congressional District Debate. I'm Nyla Boodoo, host of the 21st on Illinois Public Media. This district is one of the largest in central Illinois. It stretches from east central Illinois to the Mississippi River in the west and down to the suburbs of St. Louis. Tonight, incumbent Republican Representative Rodney Davis faces his Democratic challenger, Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan. On behalf of Illinois Public Media, I'd like to thank our partners who helped make tonight's debate possible. The League of Women Voters are our timekeepers this evening. We'll also follow league guidelines, insist that both candidates keep the focus on their own views and not on what they think about their opponent. We've already seen plenty of campaign ads. We will not be taking questions from our audience this evening, but we wanted tonight's debate to reflect what's on the minds of voters across the district. So we've been gathering questions, in all, more than 60 questions from students and residents. Don't worry, we're not going to be asking you guys all 60 of those tonight, but that's what the majority of our questions are going to come from. We also have journalists who will be helping keep our candidates on track to answer those questions and to ask a few questions of their own this evening. Jacqueline Driscoll is a reporter covering health, among other topics, for NPR Illinois. Brian Moline is a Morning Edition host and managing editor at Illinois Public Media. Here's how this evening will go. Myself or the panelists will introduce a question. Both candidates will have 2 minutes each to answer. We'll allow for a 1 minute rebuttal if necessary. There will also not be any opening or closing statements. We're gonna just jump right into things in a minute. But first, I'd like to thank our in-studio audience who are with us this evening. Our audience has agreed to hold their applause or audible reactions during the debate, except for right now as we welcome our candidates, Republican Congressman Rodney Davis and Democrat Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan. Earlier, we flipped a coin, and Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan will get the first question about education. And our questions actually include many from high schools in the area, from Urbana High School, Springfield Southeast High, and Decatur's Eisenhower High School. The first question comes by video from Riley, a student at Eisenhower.
My name is Riley Bartholomew. I'm 17 years old from Decatur, Illinois, and I will be attending college next fall. And my question to you is, what is your stance on free college for everyone?
Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan?
Thank you. Well, I first want to say thank you so much for having us, and thank you to Congressman Davis to be here. It's fun. I'm looking forward to this. So what I would say about free college is I think that we really need to focus on lowering the hurdles that so many college students face in getting an education. And so there's a few things. First of all, we need to make sure that we're talking to kids in high school about options, because there's great apprenticeship programs, there's great vocational programs, and there's great university programs. And so when they go to apply to college, and helping them to understand the financial implications, people do have to take out student loans. We have 180,000 students here in the 13th Congressional District. And the average student graduates from college with $30,000 in debt. That's insane, and we can do better. We can lower the interest rates, so with students who do have college debt, can refinance. We can also think outside the box a little bit and think about how students and colleges can align their interests. And something that we've talked about throughout the campaign is introducing something like income share agreement programs. So that's where both students and college interests are aligned, because students, while they don't incur costs up front, they do sign a contract so that after they graduate, a certain percentage of their income for a certain number of years goes back to the school. And that means that then the college also has a vested interest in making sure that that student receives a great education, that they are job ready, and it helps with job placement. So these are some of the ideas that we talk about in our town halls across the district. And I know that, you know, that for so many families, college is a struggle, and I think that there's a lot of different ways that we can help reduce the hurdles, make it affordable, and move forward.
So Ms. Dirksen-Londrigan, question was, should tuition be free, for free college for all? So it sounds like, is that a yes or a no?
I think that parents and people that I talk to throughout the district really want to make sure that students have skin in the game too. And I think that that's why the income share agreement programs are a good compromise, because they don't have the costs up front. but they do, at the other side, you know, agree to pay back the school. And I think there's other things that we can do in terms of community colleges. We have great community colleges here in the district where people can go to get two-year educations, and they do the two-by-two where they go 2 years at a community, 2 years at a four. There's things we can do to make it more affordable, but I don't see free college on the horizon. I see ways to make it more affordable for everybody.
Representative Davis.
Well, thank you, Nyla. First of all, Riley, if you're watching, thank you for the question. A great question, and I look forward to seeing what college you decide to attend. I am not for giving free education because, frankly, nothing is free. Somebody's going to have to pay for it, either through higher taxes, your parents are going to pay, or you're going to have to pay through higher taxes. What we need to do is focus on the cost of college. College has become unaffordable for many families. I'm the parent of a college senior and twin boys who are high school seniors. College affordability is an issue that we discuss in our family. While I'm blessed, we've been able to afford college for my daughter, and we're going to be able to do that because we, like many families, have invested in plans like College Illinois or other 529 savings plans. There are options for many, many families, but we have to make sure that our institutions of higher learning understand that it's not just about what a student is eligible to borrow and the debt that they could leave the college with. And Betsy's right. Students in this district, at the four public universities that I serve, the four private universities that I serve, the eight community college districts that I serve, they're leaving with way too much debt. We've seen schools like the University of Illinois, where we're here tonight, freeze tuition. That is a good first step. But we have to pass things like my bill called the Employer Participation and Student Assistance Act. It's going to allow companies to be able to invest in their new employees, in their graduates, be it through vocational education, be it through a four-year degree. This will allow a company to pay back student debt, and students wouldn't have to pay taxes on it. This is an idea that has widespread support in Washington, and I'm optimistic we're going to be able to put it through because, frankly, it has the potential to save the taxpayers upwards of $4 billion a year just by covering the debt that students may default on.
Ms. Durston-Londrigan, would you like a rebuttal?
Sure. I just also want to make sure that I add that we have to make sure that we're fully funding Pell Grants and that we're making the adjustments for cost of living. And another idea that we've talked about throughout the district is expanding our work-study programs, because we have a lot of students who are applying to college for the first time whose parents didn't attend college. But if we expand some work-study programs and take some of the students who are currently in college and have them go back into the high schools to help the students navigate the college application process and the financial aid process, that's a win-win for everybody. And another thing I'd really love to see is I would love to see us expand the public service for student loan forgiveness, because we have a lot of needs throughout the district that could really be served by students graduating, doing a couple of years of public service, and eliminating their student debt.
The next question comes from Jacqueline Driscoll on our panel, and Congressman Davis will answer first.
Congressman Davis, recent changes made by the Education Department and Secretary Betsy DeVos have allowed the dismissal of hundreds of civil rights complaints against schools and campuses. The new protocol allows the Education Department's Office for Civil Rights to disregard cases considered to be a burden on the office. What message does this decision send to students and families?
Well, we want every student to feel safe at whatever institution that they attend. And I don't always agree with this administration when it comes to education policy. I'm glad my opponent and I agree that we need to fully fund the Pell Grants that are offered to those who can least afford to attend college, those families who are struggling to be able to find the resources to send their child on to either a two-year or four-year institution. Opportunities are abound right now in higher education to be able to find that affordable option that we can put forth for our kids. But it's working with the Department of Education to make sure that they understand that our students need to feel safe on every campus. As a father of a daughter who's now been at college for 3.5 years, I fear every day that something may happen to my child. And I know parents throughout this nation have that same fear. But we also trust that the universities are doing everything they can to protect those students on every single campus. And we trust that our sons and daughters are going to be able to get that education that they are striving for and that they deserve.
Ms. Dirksen-Londrigan?
Thank you. You know, I worry a lot about these rollbacks of protections because, I mean, I see kids all over the 13th District, young men and young women. And I know that I've had my own experience dropping my children off at school. And it was an entirely different experience dropping my boys off and dropping my daughter off. There was a different set of concerns. I wish that wasn't the truth, but it just is. When I dropped the boys off, we had a lot of talks about, you know, what was expected, and we talked a lot about campus, about campus safety and looking out for other people. But when I dropped my daughter off, I was really angry. I wasn't prepared for that emotion, but I was really angry because with her, I felt like her personal safety is in jeopardy because we hear these stories all the time. And so with her, I had to go around and I needed to know where every blue light is, every one of the emergency lights that students use if they have a problem or fear for their personal safety on campus. I had her plug the campus police into her phone because she very well might need it. Until our campuses are safe for young men and young women alike, then we have a lot of work to do.
Congressman, would you like to make a rebuttal?
I know that our campuses are doing everything they can to protect every single student. And processes need to be in place when that protection does not happen for every student. You know, my biggest fear taking my boys to college next year, in this politically polarized, charged environment, I don't want somebody to do something to them just because of who their dad is. That's what concerns me as a dad right now with two kids moving on to college. That's why we've got to come together, Republicans and Democrats, and do what we can to talk about how we can get along and find solutions without such politically charged rhetoric at not just our campuses, but in society as a whole.
Let's move on to health care.
Yeah.
And we have separate questions for each candidate on this one.
Okay.
This question comes from Leroy in Decatur, and it's directed to Ms. Dirksen-Londrigan. Here's his voicemail he left us.
Oh.
I want to know how she's going to pay for all this free insurance she's wanting everybody to get. I mean, nothing's free, so where's all this money coming from?
Well, thank you, Leroy, if you're watching. And I haven't been talking about any free insurance, so that's a new one to me. You know, I got into this race because of healthcare, because for our family 9 years ago, everything changed. Our son, who was 12 at the time, was bit by a tick. He developed Rocky Mountain spotted fever and became septic, and we spent 21 days with him in the pediatric intensive care unit of our children's hospital. And I know that for our family, if we had not had access to good care, I would be a mom of two and not three. And if we had not had good insurance at the time, it would have bankrupted our family, no questions asked. And then with the ACA, they lifted the caps. And that continues to save us. And I have now put almost 60,000 miles on my car getting around our big, beautiful district. We just finished our 14th town hall, all open and free to the public. And I can tell you this, the only thing that makes our family story unique is that it's ours. Because every family has their own healthcare story. What I want to do is to first fix the ACA, because I know it doesn't work for everybody. I mean, even our family dinners on Sundays, you know, at one end of the table it works for some people, at the other end it doesn't, and I get that. But what we don't want to do is to repeal it and lose those essential health benefits. So I want to make sure that we fix the ACA first. And then what I would love to see us do is to have a public option of Medicare for rural and smaller communities and for small business owners. These are things that we talk about at our town halls. These are things that make sense. And I'm not asking anybody to have, I'm not promoting any type of free insurance. What I am promoting is a public option, a public Medicare option that will help drive down costs.
So how would you, so you've said you support maybe not free insurance, but
no,
creating a public option,
right,
to compete with private insurers,
mm-hmm,
that would cost more money. So how would you suggest that is?
No, the people pay. It's just like with your own insurance company. So if they are paying the public option, then they have an additional cost. It's not the same as it would be for senior citizens over 65.
That question was directed specifically to Ms. Dirksen-Londrigan. So this next question will come from Brian Moline to Representative Davis.
Congressman, I'd like to ask you about Medicare as well. Certainly a very popular program with senior citizens that you have pledged to support. I'm curious why you think it would be a bad idea to allow anyone to buy into the Medicare program.
Because it will break Medicare as we know it today. Our seniors need to be assured that they're going to receive the Medicare benefits that they've worked their entire career and lives for. And the plan that many Democrats, including my opponent, have said would be universal coverage has been shown to cost $32 trillion over the next 10 years. We couldn't even double the amount of income taxes on every single American to pay for this program. What we need is less government intrusion, and we need to fix the broken healthcare system that we were told the Affordable Care Act was going to do. The Affordable Care Act is broken. It's leaving many families behind with premiums of upwards of $24,000 a year when you add the deductibles that those families have to face if they're diagnosed with the same disease that my wife fought 19 years ago. My wife is a 19-year colon cancer survivor. After being misdiagnosed, she was finally diagnosed correctly, and because I had good private insurance and the ability to fire the doctor that misdiagnosed her, we were able to get her surgery. After 6 months of chemotherapy, she's now cured. And by the grace of God, it's been 19 years. However, 9 years after that diagnosis, we found out she has a genetic form of cancer called Lynch syndrome, which could affect my children. That's why I stand here and stand everywhere to say, don't believe the lies that I'm trying to take away pre-existing condition coverage. That is not the case. I have voted to repeal and replace Obamacare with the American Health Care Act. And the lies about pre-existing condition coverage being taken away have been scored a 4 Pinocchio by the Washington Post. Read the bill. In the bill, it specifically says, nothing in this bill shall allow insurance companies to deny anyone coverage for pre-existing conditions.
We know that pre-existing conditions and healthcare is an important topic for lots of people in this district. So actually, our next question is related to that as well. Lenny in Champaign wrote in to ask, in ads, you each present yourselves as protecting pre-existing condition coverage for health insurance, yet you've criticized the other on this issue. Can each of you explain just how you would protect availability of affordable health insurance covering pre-existing conditions? Ms. Dirksen-Londrigan, I'll have you start.
Sure. Well, first, I'd like to correct the record that the plan that he was referring to, the Medicare for All plan, is not something that I have supported. I have supported Medicare as a public option, which is entirely different. And then when we talk about pre-existing condition coverage, there are facts out there. And to say that Congressman Davis has supported pre-existing conditions from being discriminated against is incorrect. He has voted 11 times to repeal the ACA with no replacement, which effectively eliminates protections for people with pre-existing conditions from being discriminated against. Now, that should be fact-checked. And you should look at the AARP. And you should look at the American Cancer Society, who agree with this. They also agree that the AHCA, which is the bill that Congressman Davis celebrated on the White House lawn, would not have helped people with pre-existing conditions. It would have weakened those protections. Again, please do fact check that, because again, the AARP, the CBO, the American Cancer Society, all said that. I am agreeing with them on that. What I want to do is to make sure that when we fix the ACA, that we keep those essential health benefits, because I don't want anybody who has a pre-existing condition to go back to the dark ages where they can't even get the insurance, or B, to be priced out of it. Because to say that somebody can get it is an entirely different beast than somebody being able to afford it. It needs to be good insurance, it needs to be accessible, and it needs to be affordable.
Congressman Davis?
It's disappointing that my opponent, Betsy, is not telling the truth once again. I have not voted 11 times to get rid of pre-existing condition coverage. Those votes were votes on budget reconciliation rules. Those votes were on budget budgeting bills that specifically had a replacement language in there. I fought personally, and the vice president just last week even reminded the folks of Central Illinois that I sat around the table with him, and my number one priority when writing the AHCA, the American Healthcare Act, was protecting pre-existing condition coverage. I don't know how much more clear we can get by just reading the bill. And it specifically says nothing in this bill shall allow an insurance company to deny coverage for pre-existing conditions. Those are the facts. And I would urge everybody, go to congress.gov, type in the AHCA, and find that on the bill. But we come to this point where I actually voted to try and fix this broken healthcare system because so many families are being left behind. A friend of mine who used to be an elected official in Montgomery County, he and his wife, and I saw at a parade in Hillsboro in August, they came up to me and said, "You've got to fix our broken healthcare system." She, like my wife, was a colon cancer survivor. And they're the ones that would have to pay upwards of $24,000 in premiums and deductibles if she was diagnosed once again. Yes, they have insurance coverage. Yes, they have coverage for that pre-existing condition. But they would not be able to afford to use that coverage if she was diagnosed again. That's why our plan lowered premiums. Our plan made sure that we had a replacement that protected things like pre-existing condition coverage. It protected no lifetime caps, and it also protected the ability for young men and women to remain on their parents' insurance until age 26. Those are the facts.
Actually, Congressman Davis, the American Healthcare Act, which you did vote for as a replacement for the Affordable Care Act, created high-risk pools for those with pre-existing conditions, which is a little bit different than the protections offered by the ACA. In some states that had high-risk pools prior to the ACA, some individuals were paying double the premiums and had lifetime benefit caps. So can you please clarify the protections for pre-existing conditions that you negotiated?
Absolutely. Once again, I'll let you know that the language in the bill says no insurance company can deny anyone for pre-existing condition coverage. We protected the 10 essential health benefits that pre-existing condition coverage is listed under in the Affordable Care Act. We fixed Obamacare and kept pre-existing condition coverage. And that would mean that anyone who would want to set up an invisible risk pool that is actually in the state of Maine saved Maine seniors an average of $7,000 a year in premiums, they still would have to protect pre-existing condition coverage. That is the law, that's the bill that we passed that we wanted to sign into law. You can't get away from the language that says nothing in this bill could construe that an insurance company could deny pre-existing condition coverage to anyone. Those are the facts. I would urge you to read the AHCA and you'll see that.
Ms. Dirksen-Londrigan, since this was your initial question, you have a minute for
sure. Rebuttal. I think what that is career politicians speak for don't look too close, because it is saying that maybe they can't deny it. What it's not doing is it's not saying they can't be discriminated against for affordability. And somebody being allowed to get insurance is one thing. Somebody being able to afford the insurance is a different beast. And that was the protection that the AHCA weakened. That is why the AARP, that is why the American Cancer Society, that is why the Congressional Budget Office said that.
Brian Moline on our panel has the next question. We're going to move on to the economy and taxes. Brian?
The unemployment rate in Illinois is 4.1%, matching the lowest on record, and the economy is growing at a strong pace, with the Federal Reserve now estimating that the gross domestic product will rise 3% this year. But according to the U.S. Treasury, the federal deficit for the fiscal year that just ended was nearly 17% higher than last year, and the highest since 2012. Congressman Davis, the tax bill you supported cut the corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%, and corporate tax receipts are down 31% from last year. Was the corporate tax portion of the bill worth it?
all you have to do is look at the unemployment numbers to understand that our job creators, our companies that are some of our best employers in the 13th District, Caterpillar, ADM, State Farm, and small manufacturers like HL Precision, right here in Central Illinois, right here in Champaign-Urbana. I stood 5.5 years ago on the shop floor with Steve Hillard, who runs HL Precision, and also former Governor Edgar. And I talked about what I would do if elected to Congress, and that would be to reform our broken tax code. We did that. I went back to Steve's facility not too long ago, and the same area that I stood on had a brand new machine that he was able to invest in, because our entrepreneurs, our small business owners who are the backbone of our economy, when they don't have to pay Uncle Sam, they invest in our communities and they invest in actually creating jobs. That's why you see historic low unemployment in this nation. So low that it's never happened in my lifetime. The last time we had 3.7% unemployment was 1969. And when you have economic growth that many scoffed at before we passed our tax bill, that has exceeded expectations, you're able to see what has happened, where 88% of the projected cost of the tax cut bill has now come in the form of $1.28 trillion to the federal treasury. Now, the deficit should be a concern, but let's not kid ourselves, Brian. Over almost 70% of our spending in Washington is on the mandatory side of the ledger. We chose to invest in our military. We chose to reprioritize how Washington spends money for our priorities like cancer research, our military readiness. And what we have to do is have a Republican-Democrat solution to address the mandatory side of the ledger, like I did when I helped write the last farm bill and saved $112 billion, like we did when we passed secondary reviews of anyone on Social Security disability, so that we saved taxpayers $198 billion. Those are bipartisan solutions I've already acted on, and we need bipartisanship to make it happen.
Just a quick follow-up on the 88% number. That is a number that was cited in a Wall Street Journal op-ed from July, but the Congressional Budget Office in April said, factoring in all economic effects, that the tax cut bill would still add nearly $1.9 trillion to the total deficit between 2018 and 2028. I'm not sure where you're getting that 88% figure, but it's not squaring from what the research I've done.
Well, I'd be happy to debate the accuracy of the CBO on many of their projections. As a matter of fact, when I helped write the farm bill in 2014, they projected that our good conservative policies, changing words on pieces of paper in Washington, would save taxpayers $23 billion in mandatory spending. They came back to us less than 4 years later and said that that farm bill that I helped craft saved taxpayers $112 billion. So the Congressional Budget Office is not infallible, and I want to make sure that we choose growth. We're seeing historic low unemployment, and now we have the ability, because of economic growth, to be able to invest in programs that are very important to many of the constituents that I've talked to, and I have had bring concerns to me throughout my tenure in Congress. $5 billion we've invested over the last 2 years in curing our dreaded diseases like Alzheimer's, ALS, and cancer. We need to invest in research to cure diseases so families don't have to get a pre-existing condition too. Those are good investments, and we need to continue in a bipartisan way to work together to lower the deficit, but it's gonna take working on the mandatory side of the ledger too.
Ms. Londrigan, also on taxes, at Monday's debate in Springfield, you said that any tax reform should go from the middle class out. What exactly does that mean? Who should pay more in income taxes? Who should pay less? And if you could respond to that, please.
Well, I think in the specifics, what that means is expanding things like the earned income and child tax credit, so things that the middle class benefit from. In the big picture, what that means is, you know, I have held 14 town halls in the last couple months. I am with people from around the district all the time. And what they are telling me is that this economy isn't working for them, because they don't see wage growth. They don't see those lowered costs. They see their insurance premiums going up, or they see grocery prices going up. Their day-to-day living isn't better for them. And the tax bill, I'll tell you this, they have a very clear understanding that that tax bill was not for them. that it was a giveaway to corporations and the wealthiest among us and special interests, that $2 trillion. That really what that amounts to in real people money is $6,000 for every man, woman, and child in the United States of America. That's the price tag that we're paying. And then it comes down to how are you going to pay for it? And I think that Mitch McConnell just said loud and clear how they want to pay for it. And that is by making cuts to Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. Now, the people that are talking to me every day throughout the district, that scares them to no end. We have over 100,000 senior citizens in the 13th district who are over 65. This is what they rely on. And they deserve to retire with dignity. They have paid into this their whole lives. And so to give a $2 trillion tax break to corporations, special interests, and the wealthiest, and then turn around and say that you're going to balance it on the back of our children, our elderly, and our sick, non-starter.
Just a quick follow-up for you, Ms. Lonergan, as well. I wasn't quite clear on, at this point, with the tax cuts that passed, should any of those be repealed? Should any of those rates go back to where they were? Who should be paying more than they are currently?
I think the corporations who just got that giveaway, like the big pharma companies that I think they earned, what, they got $40 billion in that tax giveaway. They didn't need that. The middle class needs that. They're the ones who are driving our local economies. They're the ones who need more, and they need it more permanently.
First question was for you on taxes, Congressman Davis.
The families I speak to in the 13th district, the 14 counties that I'm blessed to serve, they like this tax cut. They like the fact that they have an average of $2,000 more in their family budget to do things that they want to do. We've chosen growth. My opponent wants to talk about a tax plan taking away Social Security and Medicare. Seniors, if you're watching, don't believe the lies. We are trying to protect Social Security and Medicare. We are trying to make sure that it's continued to be there, not just for you and the next generation, but we want to make sure these valuable programs are there for your grandchildren. Because right now, it's people like my opponent who have no plans that are going to see those programs be insolvent as early as 2026. That's not what I went to Washington to do. I went to Washington to protect them, but also to choose economic growth and opportunity. And that's exactly why we need to invest in more education and training and skills building that we're trying to do in the Farm Bill right now to get people who are stuck in the cycle of poverty into the jobs that are available right now in our communities at places like HL Precision right here in Champaign.
Lance in Champaign has this next question about agriculture. How should Congress act as the tariff war escalates? What would you do to ensure that farmers can sell their crops at a profit rather than rely on federal welfare checks? Ms. Dirksen-Londrigan?
Thank you. Well, you know, the Senate was able to come up with a bipartisan agreement on their farm bill. And it was unfortunate that the House, and our representative sits on the Ag Committee, left D.C. to come back and campaign and let the farm bill expire. Because here we are in the middle of soybean country, in the middle of a trade war. And our farmers, who are soybean farmers around here, have lost 20 to 25% of their crop price since March. They are scared. When I am out in the district and I am talking to people, you know, in the beginning, I really felt that they, you know, by listening to them, that they wanted to see how things were going to play out. That was early on, and I have seen a real shift in their discussions and how they're feeling. And they're scared now. They can't afford a wait and see approach. So they are upset that they don't have someone who's standing up for the farmers right here in central Illinois. And what they want is they want markets to sell to. And that's what they're fearful of, is that because we've had places like Argentina and Brazil nipping at our heels for a long time waiting to get an intro into China for the soybeans. Well, they were handed that in a silver platter. And now our farmers are worried about if they're going to have markets to sell to down the road. I don't think that's fair. I think they deserve representation who yes, of course, protects the crop insurance and brings conservation stewardship dollars here and the CRP money. But we also have somebody who stands up and is a check on this president as he enters us into a trade war that is devastating to the people in our district.
Representative Davis.
The farmers of the 13th District know who's standing up for them in Washington. They know I'm their voice on the House Ag Committee. They know I'm their voice in the conference committee to work out a final deal when we get back to Washington in November. Rest assured, the farm programs that I helped craft in 2014 that you're using in your operations right now are not going to be effective. They're based on a crop year, not a federal fiscal year that ends September 30th. Don't listen to the mischaracterizations. The facts are that we've got money in the programs that you use, and we hear from our farmers, and I don't know the farmers my opponent's talking to, but they're very happy about the preliminary deals that this administration worked out in renegotiating NAFTA, working with the EU, working to have a bilateral agreement to sell our agricultural products at levels that we saw in the TPP in countries like Japan and South Korea. This is why I've been endorsed by every ag organization that has come to see me. The Farm Bureau, the Corn Growers, the Soybean Association. They know who's standing up for them in Washington, and I'm asking for your vote to do that again.
So just to follow up, Representative Dave, the question was how should Congress act as the tariff war escalates? Would you like to answer that?
Absolutely. We should look at the results that we've seen with the preliminary trade agreements coming out of this administration. President Trump during the campaign said he wanted to renegotiate trade deals. And I talked to many of our farmers, and I was very, and still am very concerned about tariffs. But in the end, most of my farmers that I met with, they said, give this administration a chance to get a better deal. And now we've seen that deal. And all the focus can be on bad actors like China. Let's not kid ourselves. China doesn't trade fair with anyone, including the United States of America. And we've got to hold them accountable. They don't trade fair when it comes to steel. They've practically tried to decimate our domestic steel industry. Closed a plant that's right outside the 13th District in Granite City, Illinois, cost 2,000 people their jobs. I went with President Trump with his first visit back to Illinois since being elected, and it was in Granite City at the steel factory that reopened with over 500 of the 800 employees back to work cheering him on for his policies. He's doing what he said he's going to do, and our farmers are going to be the beneficiary of these new agreements.
Ms. Dirksen-Londrigan, you have a minute for response, if you
thank
like.
Thank you. Well, I was also happy to see President Trump, deal with China dumping steel and to get that steel mill back open. And I'm very proud to be endorsed by United Steelworkers. And in terms of what I'm hearing from the farmers, with this trade deal, I think that we have to look under the hood a little bit, because right now there's still a 25% tariff on Canadian steel that we use for manufacturing. Those machines are purchased by our farmers. That makes their bottom line even more expensive. And I would say that the farmers that I am talking to are the ones who are coming to free open town halls that don't need an invitation to go to a private event.
Audience. Just a reminder to the audience, let's not have audible reactions. Our next question on climate change is actually from a voicemail that Anne in Bloomington left us.
My question for the debate is, in light of the recent report from the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, what policies do you think the United States should adopt to combat global warming? Thank you.
Congressman Davis.
Well, climate change is real. And climate change needs to be addressed, but it can't be at the expense of those who work at our Clinton nuclear facility. It can't be at the expense of those who work at our coal mine in Carlinville. And it certainly can't be at the expense of those good paying jobs and the people who are employed and work at our coal-fired power plants in Springfield, Kincaid, and Coffeen. We've got to have an all of the above approach. It's not a coincidence that windmills are being produced in the same town of Clinton that we have a nuclear facility. And all of the above approach is how America can continue to lead when it comes to addressing global warming and emissions. Over the past 35 years, America has helped lead the way in emissions reduction. You don't have to go too far to Springfield, Illinois, and see one of the cleanest burning coal-fired power plants in the nation because they invested in emissions controls. Those investments would have been worth nothing if we hadn't stood up and fought the last administration who tried to take America too far and put America at a competitive disadvantage. I applauded the president for pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord because the United States of America was going to have to abide by much more stringent, higher standards than some of our developing nations and some of our biggest competitors like China. If there's going to be accountability for global warming on the global scale, the United Nations needs to make sure that countries like China are held to the same standards that many in this country, especially groups like the Sierra Club that endorse my opponent, that they want these agreements to do. As a matter of fact, the Sierra Club wants to close nuclear facilities. It wants to stop burning coal and close coal-fired power plants in this country. That would be a devastating job killer in the 13th District. That's not the answer. Let's invest in renewables, but let's pair them with baseload generators like nuclear and coal facilities that we have.
Ms. Dirksen-Londrigan, again, the question is, what policies do you think the U.S. should adopt to combat global warming?
Thank you. Well, I think it was a mistake for us to leave the Paris Climate Accord because we have been innovative leaders in combating climate change. And it's an economic issue. It's also an issue of, do you believe in clean air, clean water? And, you know, the economics of it are that in 2017, the devastation caused by climate change cost our nation $300 billion. That's money that could have been invested in modernizing infrastructure and helping us to combat climate change moving forward. Some of the policies that I think we need to look at is we have to look under the hood a little bit, and some of the rollbacks need to be rolled back in. I want to make sure that we have a buffer zone between any streams and any areas where there has been chemicals and mining, and so we don't have any more incidents like we saw over in Taylorville years ago, where coal tar had seeped up into a playground over there and children developed neuroblastoma. So there's protections that we obviously need. We also need to make sure that anybody who goes to Washington and represents our district is looking behind the scenes a little bit at what's been happening at the EPA, because it's very concerning that things like the Science Advisory Board, the rules for those committees, have been changed. So like industry workers can now sit on the Science Advisory Board, but government scientists, if they have had a grant there for the last 3 years, aren't eligible. What does that mean to us? What that means to us is that industry workers are now going to be able to identify what they believe are facts on which policy should be based, instead of nonpartisan government scientists. So it's about the regulations, and it's about also who is establishing the facts on which regulations and policy are based.
Representative, you have a minute to respond if you like.
You don't have to look too far to see that Central Illinois is home to an all-of-the-above energy approach. You see the windmills going up in our fields all throughout this district. That's the type of plan that we need to keep America competitive and also do what we can to lead the world in reducing emissions. I'm glad my opponent brought up the EPA Science Advisory Boards, because in the last farm bill, I made sure that agriculture had a seat at the table on an EPA Science Advisory Board, because it's those EPA Science Advisory Boards in the last administration that came up with the plan to regulate milk spills just like they would oil spills. Now, I don't know who's all watching, but which one can you clean up with cats?
Our next question actually comes via video, and it's on the recent Supreme Court nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh, and it comes from Peyton, a senior at Springfield Southeast High School.
Brett Kavanaugh was recently exonerated by the FBI concerning recent sexual assault claims. Do you believe that a proper investigation was carried out thoroughly? As a woman, this is important to me and several others around the nation because we want to feel like our voices are heard, and it kind of is disrespectful to those who made the claims against Kavanaugh.
Ms. Dirksen-Londrigan?
It was difficult to watch. It was difficult, particularly as a woman, to watch. I believe Dr. Ford, and I believe we have to have we need to set the precedent of believing survivors. And I did want an investigation, and I did come flat out and say that the FBI needed to investigate Judge Kavanaugh before confirming. And I really wish that the administration had let that investigation play out unimpeded with no parameters around it, because I think that we deserve that. We deserve that as women. We deserve that as citizens of the United States of America. And the Supreme Court deserves that. They deserve the integrity of a judge who has gone through a full vetting process. And I worry about what the Supreme Court will look like. I worry about the partisanship that was displayed. What I really want is for the Supreme Court of our land to maintain an impartial and unbiased balance.
Representative Davis, again, the question was, do you believe that a proper investigation was carried out thoroughly?
The citizens of the 13th District are very frustrated by the entire process to confirm Justice Kavanaugh. Justice Kavanaugh had gone through 6 FBI background checks. He had gone through an extra FBI background check called for by Republicans in the Senate. And when the time came to cast that vote, a majority of the senators believed that Brett Kavanaugh was able to serve on the Supreme Court, and they confirmed him to the Supreme Court. While I may not agree with every justice who's on the Supreme Court, I support the Supreme Court and the Senate's ability to advise and consent, to provide advice and consent for Supreme Court justices, because it protects the fabric of our society. It protects our institutions. As we move forward, we have to watch ourselves and wonder if the next Supreme Court nominee, regardless of which party is in control of the White House, goes through that same process. What does that tell our next generation about institutions as important as the Supreme Court? This is why we need to make sure that we put forth opportunities for any person to have their voice heard. Dr. Ford, I believe, was given an opportunity, not through the court process, because that's not the process that she chose. The process was through the Senate Judiciary Committee. And what we saw that day frustrated me greatly on all sides. I saw politics take over a Supreme Court nominee, a nomination process, and I think that sets a terrible precedent for the future. And I hope we all as Americans take a step back and are sure that we have a better process for anyone in the future.
So Representative Davis, I just want to make sure Peyton gets an answer to her question. It sounds like you believe a proper investigation was carried out thoroughly.
It's not really up to me to provide whether or not the proper investigation was carried out.
It's just whether or not you think it happened.
I believe Brett Kavanaugh was given 6 FBI background checks. Brett Kavanaugh was given another FBI background check throughout this Supreme Court process.
So it sounds like a yes.
And Brett Kavanaugh was given an extra FBI investigation. Even Joe Biden said the FBI, during the Clarence Thomas hearings, was not going to provide an adjudicated decision that a court of law would. So I support the fact that Brett Kavanaugh is a Supreme Court justice because the U.S. Senate confirmed him.
Ms. Dirksen-Londrigan, you have a minute response if you'd like it.
It was not a full investigation into the allegations made. That didn't happen. I think the American people deserved that. I think that he deserved to let it go one way or the other, but he deserved a clean bill. Dr. Ford deserved to have that looked into to the fullest extent of the law, and that didn't happen. It should have happened. I think it was incredibly brave of her to share her story in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee and the world. I admire her courage. I think she deserved for that to be fully investigated. And I also worry about what it tells the next generation of young women who come forward and display that kind of courage and bravery, and it doesn't even warrant a full investigation.
A quick follow-up. We heard from Peyton, who is a high school student, but this is also a contentious issue on college campuses. The 13th District contains several universities, including where we are right now, the largest university in the state. So do you feel campuses have sufficient resources and procedures to handle sexual assault and harassment allegations? Congressman Davis.
Well, this is exactly why I've tried to lead on this issue in Washington, D.C. Not just because I have a daughter at college, at one of the colleges that I serve, and sons possibly going to one of the colleges that I'm blessed to serve. This is a problem that needs to be addressed for families all throughout this nation. We need to make sure that anyone who experiences assault, anyone who is a victim of a crime, has a process that's open and allows them to be able to adjudicate that accusation through the university, through the college, through the community college, through that educational institution. And we need to be sure that those institutions, and I'm confident that the institutions that I serve in the 13th District are doing just that.
Ms. Landry.
I would like to see the process more formalized, and I think some of the rollbacks that the Secretary of Education has proposed could be dangerous to our college campuses, to the young men and young women alike. And I want to make sure that we're not close yet to a time when women and men are safe at the same level on college campuses. I would like to see us get there.
Representatives, you have a minute response if you'd like.
We'll go to the next question.
Okay. Our next question is another video from another student from Donovan, a senior at Urbana High School, and this question is about gun control.
Hey, I'm Donovan Patterson. I go to Urbana High School. I'm 18 years old, and I want to know what you guys can do to improve gun control so people who want to create harm to others can get a hold of these weapons, because I do not want my school to be on the news next.
Yeah.
Ms. Dirksen-Londrigan?
Well, thank you for your question. And, you know, I was part of a forum here in Champaign-Urbana, and it was, I think, what should be a blueprint for discussing gun violence, because it was gun owners, it was a state's attorney, it was superintendent of schools, moms demand action, students demand action, and it was a discussion. And it was a type of discussion that I have had with people throughout the 13th District. And it's about how we can reduce gun violence. You know, here in the 13th District, in the last 4 years, we've lost 56 children under the age of 17 to gun violence. And I always want to make sure that I bridge the gap, because we have so many different parts to our district that are, that are like families like mine, that are legal responsible gun owners, and that's part of the community fabric. Gun owners and non-gun owners alike have children and grandchildren in school. Gun violence is all of our concerns. I can tell you that I think that 90% of Americans agree on universal background checks, where we check for violent history before giving people guns. And we can keep guns out of the hands of violent offenders and domestic abusers and those who are dangerously mentally ill. These are things that we can do if the people at the table have the political will to do it. And I have said time and again, I will take not one dime from the NRA because I don't want their money. And Congressman Davis has taken a lot of money from the NRA. And I think that that's reflected in his votes.
Congressman?
Well, Donovan, I don't want any school to go through what the tragedies we saw at places like Parkland and others just this past year. We have to make sure that we do what's best to secure our schools. As a matter of fact, after Parkland, I went back to Washington and wondered aloud to my team as to what happened to the old Cops Secure Our Schools program. I found out before I got to Washington that that program was deauthorized and defunded. So I worked to reauthorize it and worked to put over $150 million back into that program. The state of Illinois and local school districts right here in the 13th District are reaping the benefits of that investment. They're able not just to partner to secure our facilities to make sure something that happened in Parkland does not happen at schools in this district. They also are implementing new ideas like bringing in mental health counselors to address young men and women who may be about to get to that crisis stage. And that's why we've done things in Washington already to fix the flaws in our national background check system. We've done things already in Washington to ensure that we not just focus on the firearm side of the equation, but we address the mental health side of the equation. I get accused of taking money from the NRA. I'm an NRA member. I give them money each year. I believe in the Second Amendment. And my belief was hardened because, Donovan, I experienced gun violence myself. I was on the baseball field in Alexandria, Virginia, June 17th of 2017, when a crazed gunman from Illinois screaming healthcare came to kill me and my friends because he disagreed with us politically. I saw good guys with guns fire back and save us all. Criminals don't care if they fill out the correct form for a FOID card. They don't care if they legally purchase a firearm. And we need to make sure that every American has the right to protect themselves.
Ms. Dirksen-Londrian, you have a response if you'd like it.
I also believe in the Second Amendment. Again, I come from a family and a community of legal responsible gun owners. 90% of Americans agree that we need federal universal background checks, checks on violent history before people purchase guns. 73% of NRA owners believe the same thing. You know, this is not a political issue. It shouldn't be. And I can tell you that in the town halls that I have held, again, these are all open free to the public. These are Democrats, Republicans, independents, whoever shows up. We have open discussions about things like this. And we don't always agree, but that's democracy. We talk about solutions and we find common ground. And I think it's unfortunate that my opponent has refused to do open, free to the public town halls and has outright said that he wouldn't meet with people who disagree with him or politically opposed to him. I counter, that's how we make progress, is by meeting with people who we don't always agree with and figuring it out together.
I'm afraid that is all we have time for this evening, but I want to thank both of our candidates this evening, Representative Davis, Ms. Dirksen-Londrigan. I want to thank our panelists as well, Jacqueline Driscoll with NPR Illinois, Brian Moline with Illinois Public Media. Thanks to our studio audience and to everyone who submitted your questions for this evening's debate. And thanks to our debate partners, NPR Illinois in Springfield, the NAACP of Champaign County, the League of Women Voters of Champaign County, and the University of Illinois Student Government. To all the voters, a reminder, Election Day is November 6th. And you can find everything you need to know about voting in Illinois and your candidates with our Illinois Newsroom Voter Guide. That's online. You can find that at ilvotes2018.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for coming. Thanks for listening. Good night.